This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson, and today we are going to the ends of the earth to report on climate change. We begin in Antarctica. That's the sound of penguins nearby Thwaites Glacier. Thwaites is a huge glacier, more than a half a mile thick and the size of Great Britain. And it's no surprise, it's melting. Many scientists are predicting that Thwaites may be doomed to crumble into the ocean. If that happens, global sea levels could rise up to 2 feet just from this one glacier. But that's not even the bad news, because this glacier is holding back another colossal sheet of ice, kind of like a cork in a wine bottle. If all of it slips into the ocean, sea levels could rise by 11 feet. Few people have ever stepped on Thwaites Glacier, and no one has ever traveled by sea along the glacier's front until now. A group of scientists spent 2 months aboard a research vessel to study Thwaites up close. Reporter Carolyn Beeler from the public radio show The World joined them in this first-of-its-kind expedition.
My journey starts on a windy day at the end of January at a port near the southern tip of Chile. I walk across a gangplank to board an icebreaker the length of a football field.
Here we are.
With nearly 60 scientists, staff, and crew.
Just walked on the ship. My new home for 8 weeks.
In port, the Nathaniel B. Palmer feels solid and stable, like a floating college dorm with a cafeteria and bright green flooring. But as we sail south from Chile and through open ocean, 20-foot swells toss it around like it's a little dinghy. One day, about a week into the trip, keyboards are skittering across desks in the computer lab. Chairs crash from one side of the room to the other. I get thrown out of the one I'm sitting in.
Ow.
Yeah, I'm just gonna wait a minute to stand up.
The bruise on the back of my head is my first reminder this trip of the power of the ocean, but it won't be my last. This same ocean is responsible for melting Thwaites Glacier. Winds are now pushing warm ocean waters up underneath part of the glacier that extends out into the sea. If that part breaks off, the entire glacier would be vulnerable. Early into our journey, I talked to Rob Larder, the ship's chief scientist, about research suggesting the collapse of Thwaites is inevitable.
The suggestion was that Thwaites Glacier had already passed the point of no return, and whatever you do now, the retreat is really inevitable.
Rob works for the British Antarctic Survey. He's traveled to Antarctica nearly 24 times.
If they're right, the question then becomes, how fast is it going to retreat? How fast are we going to lose that ice?
If Thwaites collapses, it would push up sea levels around the world. Entire neighborhoods in Boston, where I live, could be underwater. From Miami to Mumbai, cities across the globe would need to plan for that sea level rise. But, Rob says,
I don't think everybody is convinced that it is necessarily inevitable at the moment.
Are you convinced that it's inevitable?
I'm keeping an open mind. I hope it's not as bad as some of us fear it is, because I've got teenage children and I'd like them to live in a world where it's not a disaster scenario.
As we sail south, the specter of this glacier looms over me. This research is sobering, but actually doing it is also exciting. No one's ever been in front of the main part of Thwaites Glacier, where we plan to go.
Basically, we have no idea what the ocean looks like there.
Peter Sheehan works at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's never been to Antarctica before. Once we get to Thwaites, he'll be measuring how much warm water is reaching it for the very first time.
So that is really exciting. That's kind of like harking back to that ancient age of Antarctic exploration. We're going somewhere that no one's ever been before.
No one's ever been there before because the sea in front of much of Thwaites is usually covered in ice. We break through some of that ice en route to the glacier. The ship slams its heavy nose on thick slabs of ice to crack them, then sails through the black gash of open water. The best place to record this is inside the bow of the ship.
I can feel when we go over it, you can sort of feel vibrations of the ship going over the ice.
This is also where the food is stored, so I'm watching some giant bottles of olive oil shake as I record.
And then you can hear the ice dumping and then scraping against the front of the ship.
This shaking stops as we get closer to the glacier. The area is nearly ice-free. The morning we're set to arrive at Thwaites, I set my alarm for 4 a.m. and get out of my bunk to walk up 4 flights of stairs to the bridge. And there it is, a cliff of ice, 6 or 7 stories tall. The captain and chief mate are silently navigating along its face. It's still dark and foggy, and they use a spotlight to look for stray icebergs.
It's snowing, and the beam of the spotlight on top of the ship is lighting up a column of swirling snow.
Morning. Peter is working the night shift and comes to look out the window with me. The long wall of white ice in front of us almost glows in the darkness.
Didn't expect we'd get so close to it. It's huge. But it looks like lots of the icebergs that we've seen. This just keeps going. Maybe it's the light. It looks kind of mystical. That kind of blue tinge to everything.
Yeah, like I'm whispering and I don't know why.
You can Google image everything these days. So if you asked me to picture an ice shelf 24 hours ago, this is what I'd have thought it would have looked like. But there's something different about seeing it in person. That sense of reverence that, you know, you're whispering and you don't know why. Nobody whispers in front of Google Images.
Nobody has been where we are right now before.
No.
As the sun rises, the ship wakes up and people stream up here to the bridge. The mood shifts from reverential to celebratory, almost like a party. Scientists lean against the railing on the catwalk that wraps around the bridge, joking about how they're itching to drop scientific instruments into the sea here.
But I want to throw something over the board.
Remember, this is the first time humans have sailed across the front of the glacier like we're doing now. And we're close, about the length of a football field away, but it feels even closer. Almost close enough to reach out and touch its chalky surface, or the cracks that glow aquamarine. 6 decks up, we can't quite see over the top of the glacier. I watch the ice go by for a while with Rob.
It's fantastic. This is a critical boundary in the world today. This is where rapid change is really happening, and we're actually standing and looking at the bit that's rapidly changing.
As the day progresses, the mood shifts again to something more somber, because we start to actually see those rapid changes. Ice shelves usually look like vertical cliffs, walls of ice, solid and several stories tall with flat tops, like a butcher block table. But as we travel along the glacier face, Thwaites looks anything but solid. Instead, it's sloping toward the sea, almost like a sand dune.
It's curving down, gradually rolling off. The actual cliffs are not very high at all.
So it doesn't look like ice shelves I've seen before.
Like Rob, Lars Bouma from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland spends the next few days puzzling over the shape of the ice sheet. He's struck by the parts of the glacier that look jagged and bumpy, like piles of giant rocks covered in blankets of snow.
This one looks like big icebergs and ice cubes just frozen together. It looks very chaotic.
And did that surprise you?
Absolutely.
And that surprised me, that even the experts weren't expecting this, that the glacier would so obviously look like it's falling apart. While we're standing up on the bridge, sonar equipment attached to the bottom of the ship is mapping the seafloor below us for the first time.
Test 1, 2.
Okay, do you think we can really hear ourselves?
Maybe.
Late in the afternoon, as fog cocoons the ship, Joey Patterson tries to bounce her voice off the lumpy glacier face in front of us.
Whoop!
I don't know, did you hear it?
I heard it.
Totally did. We're moving away, though.
Yeah.
We're gonna lose it.
Oh, that was amazing.
You can bounce your voice off the glacier, Johan.
Yeah, there's an echo.
Do it. Let's hear it.
Ho!
Ho!
No, we're just all right.
Woo!
Joey would later tell me this was a weird moment for her, both thrilling and sad. Because this jumbled glacier in front of us, it's almost like staring climate change in the face. A few minutes later, she and marine ecologist Guy Bortolotto spot a corner of ice nearly cleaved off the glacier.
That tiny part looks like it's gonna fall at any second.
Yeah.
He jokes he could almost blow it away.
This one too. That one too.
For Peter, seeing the jumbled up face of the glacier made climate change feel less academic.
The knowing part hasn't changed. You know, I know that we're not in a particularly good position. That hasn't changed. But yeah, it maybe feels a bit more real now.
A few days later, the map of the sea floor right in front of the glacier is filled in. Peter and other oceanographers have measured the temperature of the water in front of Thwaites for the very first time. All of this will feed into models that will predict how soon Thwaites might collapse and how much it will add to global sea levels when it does. But the question that Lars Bouma asks is when we're going to do something about it.
We have to change policies. The question is, how long will it take? Because the longer we wait, the worse these impacts will be.
Back at the beginning of this trip, Chief Scientist Rob Larder told me he was keeping an open mind about whether the collapse of Thwaites was inevitable. At the end of our cruise, I asked him that same question again.
There have been studies published suggesting that Thwaites is past its tipping point and its collapse is inevitable. Do you think that is the case?
Do I think it's the case? I think that's more likely than not, yeah.
And does he think the entire Mexico-sized piece of ice around Thwaites will also collapse?
I guess if you're asking me to project hundreds of years into the future, unless there's some amazing change where we manage to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, then I think, yeah, the West Antarctic ice sheet is ultimately doomed, yeah.
Very roughly, that would mean the storm surges that flooded Lower Manhattan during Hurricane Sandy would become permanent. The new baseline sea level. For Rob, the bigger question now is how fast that'll happen. After more than 2 months away, I fly back home to Boston, where the airport is surrounded by the Atlantic. Looking out the window at the runways dead-ending into the ocean, what I saw in Antarctica feels hard to shake.
Carolyn Beeler is a reporter for the public radio show The World. You can find more of her stories from Antarctica at theworld.org/Antarctica. Up next, we go from the bottom of the globe to almost the very top. how melting ice is changing global military strategy in the Arctic. That's next on Reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letzi.
This is the roof of the world. The vast, desolate stretch of polar wasteland called the Arctic.
This Air Force documentary tells the story of a monumental construction project. In the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War, the U.S. and Canada worked together to build a series of radars all the way across the Arctic. Officially, they were known as the Distant Early Warning Line.
New Line, they called it. Starting in the west at a point above the Arctic Circle in Alaska, it would stretch across Alaska and the Canadian Arctic for 3,000 miles.
Dew line radars acted as kind of a tripwire, looking out for Soviet long-range bombers, because the quickest route to attack went over the top of the Earth.
If modern bombers carrying modern bombs over the polar ice cap were to cross the Arctic Circle at midnight, they could destroy virtually any Canadian or American city before dawn.
And nearly 70 years later, some of these same radar sites are still in use, still crucial to international security. Reporter Michael DeIwana from the public radio station KUNC in Colorado has been investigating how climate change is threatening some of these radars and posing new risks to the national security of the United States.
Major Christopher Perham escorts me through a locked metal gate. He's with the Alaska Air National Guard at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage.
I do this wrong every day because I have two different codes.
At a security door, he fumbles to punch numbers into a keypad.
I tell you, the amount of like that it takes to get in here, like security and stuff, it's just crazy.
Major Perham is wearing a green flight suit with a patch that says Eyes of the North. Inside the building, he takes me down a long hallway past framed photos of old military aircraft, then to another security door, entering more codes.
So we'll get you in, and then what you'll see here is the operations floor, kind of NORAD style, you know, you see down.
Inside a square room, about 40 troops in American and Canadian uniforms huddle around flashing computer screens. This is the 176th Air Defense Squadron. 24 hours a day, every single day of the year, troops are in this room keeping watch.
We have approximately 40 operators on a day-to-day basis that conduct the mission. We have several sections. We've got identification. We have surveillance.
By surveillance, Major Perham means using radars to monitor more than a million miles of airspace over and around the Arctic. They're not just looking for Russian bombers, they're finding them and scrambling American and Canadian fighter jets. Outside this building, F-22 Raptors sit at the ready.
So if you turn around, there's a wall of stars that we have, and every time we conduct an intercept, we put a star up.
As I turn around, I see plaques, a lot of them. They line the wall. Each small, thin block of rectangular wood represents an intercept, a time when fighter jets were sent up to meet and potentially shoot down foreign aircraft.
A snapshot in time of where we intercepted, what type of aircraft we intercepted, and the date.
These plaques go back decades, almost like a timeline of tensions between the two countries.
89, 90, 91. So that's the end of the Cold War.
Right, that was the end of the Cold War.
The plaques slow down around the time the Berlin Wall came down, then stop completely by 1994.
We had guys sitting here for this mission, you know, intercepting Russian aircraft, and nothing. And we were just practicing and practicing and practicing and practicing.
But then, in the early 2000s, I noticed the plaques pick back up again.
And then we started intercepting more Russian aircraft, as you see.
In fact, just last week, in an unusual show of force, more than a half dozen Russian bombers and fighter jets were intercepted off the coast of Alaska, thanks in large part to NORAD radars. But three radar sites at the center of this operation are now in jeopardy because of climate change. Sea ice used to protect them, along with the support buildings and airstrips needed to keep them running. But now that Arctic ice is melting, storm surges endanger the radar sites. The Air Force says it's all happening way faster than predicted. It will cost a small fortune to protect these radars. At just one location, a mile-long seawall made of stone will total $48 million. And costs for the other two sites haven't even been released yet. I want to get my eyes on one of these radars up close. I meet Air Force Colonel Dan Lemon at the base's airport.
So, Colonel, I'm recording. Can I record as we walk to the plane?
Absolutely.
Tell me where we're going.
We're going to Tin City. It's along the Bering Sea.
I plan to visit a radar at sea level, one of the ones threatened by climate change. But because of weather and logistics, Colonel Lemon says we're going to Tin City.
On a clear day, you can see Russia from there. So hopefully, the pilots have told me that it's supposed to be a clear day. But in Alaska, the weather can change on a dime, but let's hope it keeps that way.
Tin City is a spectacular radar station, perched high atop a mountain and almost invisible because it's painted white like the snow.
Chris, you good?
Yeah.
We get into a small plane with two propellers, two pilots, two PR staffers, and the guy Colonel Lemon calls Chief, his right-hand man. I sit facing the colonel, and we just chat. I ask him what he thinks of Alaska.
People always say, you know, you either love it or hate it, and I love it.
You love it?
Yeah.
What's the love about it?
Everyone's really friendly, small-town feel, right? Alaskans kind of just make you feel like you're part of the family.
Yeah.
And definitely God's country, though, right?
Yeah.
You'll see that today.
As we take off, we get a glimpse of Mount Denali, North America's highest peak, rising from the clouds. Then veer west toward the Bering Sea. Looking out the window, I see chains of nameless mountains and twisting frozen rivers that stretch to the horizon. As much as I'm flying over the middle of nowhere, I'm at the heart of a military universe. Air Force officials shared a map to help me understand why. It shows Anchorage at the center of the world. Berlin is a 9-hour flight away. Moscow and Beijing are only about 8 hours away. That's because the Arctic is a shortcut to the other side of the globe. And enemy aircraft using that shortcut could become harder to track if any of these radars are knocked out by climate change.
Everything you read, all the science that you see, is that we have underestimated the speed at which this is going to happen.
Former Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus.
This is not theoretical. This is a danger today.
In March, Mabus and 58 former high-ranking military and national security leaders wrote a letter to President Trump. Admirals, generals, secretaries of state and defense all signed the letter. It includes the line, "Climate change is real. It's happening now. It's driven by humans, and it is accelerating." The group was responding to news that the president had created a new team to review military intelligence documents and question any instance where climate change was mentioned as a threat to national security.
it's like, okay, we don't like the facts, so we're going to try to muddy the waters. We're going to try to change the science here.
This isn't new. In 2017, the Trump administration stripped most climate change references from the Defense Department report on national security strategy. Mabus and other leaders are beside themselves because they believe the president is ignoring one of the biggest threats facing the country, not just in the Arctic, but everywhere.
If we don't do something to reverse or slow the sea level rise, the largest Navy base in the world, Norfolk, will go underwater. It will disappear, and it will disappear within the lifetimes of people alive today.
It's not just former leaders who are worried. In January, the Defense Department identified 79 military bases at risk because of climate change. The threats include drought, wildfires, expanding deserts, and in the case of those Alaskan radars, flooding and thawing permafrost. Finally, our plane arrives at the edge of it all, the slow black waters of the Bering Sea. Colonel Lemon points out the window at a mountain.
That's where the radar is, right on top of the...
It's a little ball on top
of
the mountain.
Yes, yes.
From here, it looks like a golf ball perched atop a white pyramid. I ask how people get up to it.
Yeah, very carefully, but yes, the weather's good, we'll go up there.
At the base of the mountain is Tin City, which isn't a city at all. It's a shoebox-shaped military installation. The plane bounces down softly on a gravel landing strip. A PR officer jokes.
Oh, damn, no cell phone reception.
What? What? That's un-American. What the heck?
As the plane door opens, a single gust of wind sucks the heat out from the cabin. I zip up my coat and follow the others down the steps onto the icy runway. There are blue skies and it's cold, about 8 degrees Fahrenheit. We make our way to a large garage and come face to face with a red tank-looking vehicle.
It's a mini bulldozer, right, that can take passengers too.
Colonel Lemon tells me it's called a piston bully. This is how we're going to get to the top of the mountain, to the golf ball. I pile in back with the colonel, his chief, and the PR officers. The cabin is basically a box with two benches facing one another. It's tight. We squeeze in shoulder to shoulder.
I think this vehicle's like out of the movie Transformers or something, you know.
They tell me the journey will take about an hour along a steep, winding road carved into the side of the mountain, just wide enough to fit the bully going one way, up or down, and nothing else. The bully rocks as the driver hops into the cab, which is separate from us. So the colonel speaks to him by walkie-talkie.
Everybody ready?
Ready.
A plow on the front clears snow and ice as we begin rumbling up the road. About a year ago, Colonel Lemon says a huge storm iced over the door that leads to the radar. Troops had to be called in to hack away at it. Anytime there's a problem with the radar here, there's a problem at NORAD 2.
They don't like sights being down, and we try to get them back up for them.
The piston bully creaks and churns as we climb switchback after switchback. The views get more harrowing. I'm on the inside, the mountainside. The colonel's chief is sitting on the other side, looking straight down. He says the track is right off the edge of the cliff. Several of us sit back deeper in our seats, gripping our gear tighter.
All right, everybody got to hang on. We're going to go down a little hill.
Okay, we're going to go down a little hill, so then hang on.
And then we'll spin around and bring it back up to the core.
Thank God they told us that, right?
The piston bully comes to rest on a small hill in front of the radar. There's a porch extending out from the doorway that looks almost like cake with layers and layers of vanilla icing spray painted on. Our driver chips away with a shovel before opening the door. We enter the radar room. It's filled with buzzing machinery. I wonder, how far across the Bering Strait can the radar see?
In terms of how powerful the radar is it one of the more powerful radars?
Can I tell them the range?
No, we can't. We
yeah,
can't
that's what I thought.
You can't say how what the rain
nope.
is.
Nope. I know what it is, but I'm not telling you. Yeah. Yeah. I can't.
Is that classified?
It's classified. Okay. Most everything up here is classified. I will tell you that.
I climb up a small flight of metal stairs, and now I'm under the radar, as close as I'll get to it. Just above my head, electromagnetic waves pulse and travel some classified distance away. Right now, this whirring, whooshing relic is guarding against nuclear attack. And it's connected to a string of other radars doing the same thing. Together, they're that tripwire, that early warning. And because of climate change, they're vulnerable. When permafrost is no longer perma, when sea ice just becomes sea, it's not just radars that are made vulnerable. Now there are also huge economic stakes at play. The Coast Guard estimates the Arctic holds 13% of the world's undiscovered oil, a third of the world's undiscovered gas, and about $1 trillion in gold, platinum, and other minerals. As ice melts, many of those riches will become available for the first time ever, and Russia is laying claim.
Ключом к развитию русской Арктики, регионов Дальнего Востока, станет Северный морской путь.
Last year, in his annual address to the Federal Assembly, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about expanding shipping channels in the Arctic, which would trim thousands of miles off merchant trips. By 2025, Putin says, Arctic shipping could grow by 10 times. Russia has also reopened Arctic military bases that have been shuttered since the Cold War. For Republican Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, all of this raises alarms.
As the sea ice is receding, our strategic interests as a nation, and to be honest, our sovereignty as a nation, become increasingly important.
Senator Sullivan worries the U.S. isn't ready for climate change in the Arctic, and that Russia is. He points to icebreakers as an example. Ironically, icebreakers will become even more important as sea ice thins, because you need them to keep shipping lanes open. And Russia has an Arctic armada.
The Russians have 40 icebreakers, some of which are nuclear-powered, and they're building 13 more, many of which are weaponized.
By contrast, the U.S. only has 2 icebreakers, and they're both 4 decades old. So while President Trump continues to deny and debate the causes of climate change, here in the Arctic, potential foes like Russia are preparing to take advantage of it, to gain the upper hand. I turned back to former Navy Secretary Ray Mabus to see what he makes of what Russia's doing.
The very notion that they're spending all this effort in the Arctic, I think, makes it a far more dangerous place. And it is no longer the case, like it was for a long time, that the Arctic was pretty much non-political. And it was because you just couldn't get there much. There wasn't a way to exploit those minerals on the seafloor, or there weren't any shipping lanes. And now, because of climate change, there is. And so the chances of encounters that may go wrong go up, and they go up more dramatically the more the ice melts.
Back in the piston bully, the radar fades behind us as we descend the switchbacks. We round a corner, and there, I get a great view of the Bering Strait. The bully stops on a ridge, and we all get out to look. Contractor Jeff Bolds points at 2 specks out in the middle of the strait. They're about 50 miles away.
It's hard to tell, but the little dot there kind of poked out front,
that's Little Diomede, and then the big part is Big Diomede Island. Okay. Little Diomede's America, Big Diomede's Russia.
And beyond that, as I squint my eyes, are mountains that seem to go forever. That's the Russian mainland. Looking at it reminds me of something the former commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Paul Zukov, told me. He compared military strategy in the melting Arctic to a board game. He says Russia is playing high-level chess. And the U.S., he says, is playing plain old checkers.
Michael DeJuana is a reporter with public radio station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. Military installations aren't the only thing at risk in Alaska. For our next story, we'll head more than 100 miles further north to Kivalina, a native village that could soon disappear off the face of the earth. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. For our final story, we're traveling to a coastal village in western Alaska, above the Arctic Circle, a village that, because of climate change, could be underwater in less than a decade. It's called Kivalina. Kids are the first thing you notice in Kivalina. They play outside, they ride all over on snowmobiles and four-wheelers. They seem to be everywhere.
What are you guys doing? Hey, Erica.
We're playing.
That's reporter Emily Schwing.
You're playing? What are you playing?
Vampires and humans.
Vampires and humans? Are there vampires in Kivalina?
No, we're just playing.
You're just playing. Okay. Okay. Whew.
The village sits on a sliver of sand and gravel. It's a barrier island just 800 feet wide and about half a mile long, with water on each side. A lagoon sits to the east, and then a vast stretch of trees, tundra, and rolling snowy hills. To the west is the Chukchi Sea. In the winter, the deep blue-black water is covered in ice and extends to the horizon.
It's a microphone, right?
I must down.
Don't yell in it, though, because you'll blow my ears. If you do that, I'm listening, so it hurts my ears.
Hello.
Well, tell me your name.
I'm Ariel.
This sea ice acts like a buffer. It protects the village from storms. But in a warming climate, there's not as much ice as there used to be. It forms later in the fall and melts earlier in the spring, allowing giant waves to pummel the island. So bit by bit, flooding and erosion are swallowing Kivalina. And the lives of the few hundred people who live here, including these kids, are in danger.
The song Lost Boy?
I don't know that song. Do you want to sing it for me?
I don't really know it.
I know a part of it.
Yeah? Is it a good song?
I am a lost boy from Neverland, usually hanging out with Peter Pan.
The surest way to keep people safe is to move them permanently, to relocate the village. In fact, residents here have been asking the federal government for help with that since at least the 1960s. Emily is in Kivalina to find out why more than 50 years later, that still hasn't happened.
I bump along in the back of a four-wheeler behind Kelly Hawley. She's 30 years old and a mother of five. She has big round cheeks, she wears thick overalls, and she drives pretty fast. About a quarter mile from the center of the village, we stop so Kelly can show me where her Aka is buried. Aka means grandmother in Inupiaq, the indigenous language people speak here.
Busy, quiet woman, always there. She used to be cutting caribou or cleaning up. I have a lot of stories, but I don't know which one to tell, so.
On this side of the landing strip, rows of wooden crosses poke out of the snow. They cast long shadows in the springtime sun.
Oh, there she is, Louise.
Louise Polly, yeah.
Oh, your grandmother was born in 1924.
Yep. And her daughter is right here, my dad's sister, Ewa Stalker.
Yeah, so this is just like your whole family.
Yeah.
Nearly everyone in Kivalina is Alaska Native, Inupiaq. They've lived in this region off the land for more than 10,000 years. Hunting's a way of life and the main source of meat. Seals, caribou, all kinds of fish.
I mean, Does it make you sad to think that in 100 years, maybe all these grave sites might be gone?
Yeah.
It could happen way sooner. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers estimates that by 2025, all of Kivalina could be entirely underwater in a big storm. That's only 6 years from now. Kelly's ancestors didn't choose to live here, at least not permanently. The Inupiaq used to spend summers in tents along Kivalina's beach, They'd go fishing and take boats across the lagoon to pick berries. And when winter set in, they'd move inland to hunt caribou for food. In other words, they were semi-nomadic. But in 1905, the federal government built a school on the island, and parents were threatened with jail time or losing their kids altogether if they didn't send them to school. Ever since, people have lived on this tiny spit of sand and gravel. We take Kelly's bright red four-wheeler a few hundred feet around the active runway to where the Chukchi Sea meets the island. Last fall, a storm brought gale-force winds. Kelly says giant waves eroded an enormous piece of the beach.
About 20 feet high and 15 feet of land.
Going outwards. Yeah. Okay.
She raises her arms above her head to emphasize how big the waves got. The piece of land that washed away was about as long as a pickup truck and as wide as a city bus.
It came really close to the runway, maybe like 5 feet off the runway. So we're like right there.
Was it scary?
It was scary, yeah. It wasn't to where we have to evacuate, though.
There is no evacuation plan that could quickly get people to higher ground. That's because the only way off the island is by boat or plane, which may not be possible during a big storm. As Kelly and I talk, the second airplane of the day arrives with a mail delivery and food to keep the local store stocked. Some of the passengers are coming home from doctor's appointments in Anchorage.
It's kind of weird to be standing right here on the runway.
It's March. Everything is buried under a thick crust of wind-buffeted snow. So I can't see the sand or the gravel that washed away, but there are hints at what happened. The tops of giant sandbags, half the size of a small car, peek out of the snow. Local volunteers used heavy machinery to pile them here years ago in an effort to protect the runway. This past fall and winter, Kivalina was hit with more than a dozen storms. People saw days of big winds, high waves, and there was less ice than normal to protect the shoreline. Residents like Kelly have mixed feelings about what to do.
I keep thinking, like having double thoughts to move out of Kivalina, but then my family grew here, so I never left yet.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking to leave now, but I was thinking in the future, maybe I should.
Leaving is complicated. Imagine if your entire community had to move. How would you and your neighbors handle it? How would you decide where to rebuild everything? Schools, houses, local businesses. And how would you pay for it? Way up here, construction costs a fortune. People in Kivalina have been grappling with these issues for decades and working with state and federal agencies to come up with a plan. Find a place where people are safe that also allows for them to preserve their unique culture. But the process is mired in red tape and bureaucracy, and the clock is ticking. This spring was one of the warmest ever in Alaska. In March, sea ice on the Bering and Chukchi Seas was at record low levels for that time of year. Without that ice to protect them, flooding and erosion in Kivalina are getting worse.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm here to visit with your grandmother.
Yes, she's home.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Lucy Adams lives in a small gray house that overlooks the Chukchi Sea. She's one of Kivalina's few remaining elders. Outside the door, a wolf pelt hangs in the wind. Next to that, a rabbit pelt, and the reddish-brown, fuzzy skin cut from the lower legs of a caribou. The rest of the caribou is surely tucked away in a giant chest freezer outside the door. Lucy sits at her kitchen table in front of a sewing machine, slowly piecing together a new lining for her coat. A parki, she calls it. She was born in 1933. The coffee mug on her table says so. Aged to perfection.
Do you think you live in a good place now? Do you feel safe living here on the island?
I can understand you when you talk fast.
I talk too fast. Sorry.
Lucy looks at me sideways, scrunches up her nose, and shakes her head. Her first language was not English. It was Inupiaq.
I was asking if you think that the island is a good place to live.
Oh, It's not safe anymore. It's eroding. It's getting small. It's not safe to live here. We always just pray to be safe.
Until there's a plan and government money to help relocate the village, Lucy is stuck. Stuck here where it no longer feels safe, but also stuck in limbo.
It would be good to have running water instead of going back and forth to this water to cook and to wash dishes.
Kivalina has never had running water, and since the village needs to be relocated, regional and state leaders won't help install it on the island. This is the case with lots of infrastructure needs. Why beef up a seawall, build a new school, or put in pipes for a water system if it's all going to flood?
So this gray bucket by your door here
is pure just water.
Okay. So that's the water. And
this ice water. Okay. Drinking water.
There's a huge 30-gallon gray rubber trash can filled with water next to the door. This water comes from the Kivalina River, 7 miles away. Lucy's grandson chops giant chunks of ice out of the river and hauls it home for her with a snowmobile.
Every day.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
Do you ever dream about having like a bathtub or a shower?
That dream is just a dream. It can happen.
Lucy drops her chin to her chest, inspects her handmade shirt, a cusbuck. It's purple, her favorite color. Then she grumbles one more time, quietly, to herself.
It can't happen to Kivalina.
It can't happen to Kivalina, Lucy says.
It's just a dream.
She tells me it's just a dream. Lucy and a lot of other people I talk with in Kivalina are really frustrated they have to keep going without. Without running water, without enough housing, without a school that's big enough for all the kids who live here. By far, though, the thing people are most frustrated about is that they're still here, living on this island where their lives are in danger. Millie Hawley is Kivalina's tribal administrator.
Our people have fought and fought and fought. Our parents and our grandparents have fought and discussed and held meetings over time and again.
Millie's face is straight. Her mood is dark. She seems exhausted. For decades, she's been fighting to make relocation happen.
Day in and day out with the federal governments, with local governments, with the state, and tell them, hey, we need help here. We need, you guys caused us to live here by calling our people to attend school here.
In the early 2000s, she thought maybe Kivalina was getting close to finding a way off the island. The whole village worked for at least a decade to agree on a new location. They finally came to a consensus on where they wanted to move, but a 2006 report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers called the site infeasible.
You should have seen and heard Kivalina back then when they got that document. It was like we had a funeral for at least 7 years. We grieved. There was no hope. There was no no more fight. It was dismal.
The Army Corps report describes the village's site as geotechnically inappropriate and strategically problematic. In other words, the ground was unstable, mostly gravel. And on top of that, climate change threatened to erode the land there too. But the report says the do-nothing approach wouldn't work either. It says the village definitely needed to move. And more than a decade ago, that cost was estimated at $275 million. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska says what's never been clear is where all that money might come from.
So a plan may be identified, the practical fiscal reality of how we implement that plan becomes a much greater challenge.
The money to move Kivalina could be pulled from a tangle of state and federal agencies, likely more than a dozen. I've interviewed people from those agencies for this story, but I didn't get any clear answers about how Kivalina's relocation might happen. One agency, FEMA, even has emergency management in its title. But because of the way Congress allocates disaster response money, the agency doesn't seem fully equipped to respond to a slow-moving disaster caused by thinning ice and sea level rise. In the age of climate change, Senator Murkowski says things need to be streamlined.
In my view, there is not one agency that is in charge. That makes this an even larger problem when it's not coordinated.
The residents of Kivalina could become some of America's first climate change refugees, but they won't be the last. If the U.S. government can't help keep these 400 people above water, how will it respond as the climate crisis grows? What about when rising seas threaten much larger cities like Miami, Charleston, and New York?
I just wanted to ask you, if you think the federal government is ready and prepared, if something were to happen today to deal with, you know, so-called climate change refugees?
I would say no. The direct answer is we are not, as a government, prepared. I think most people would say no.
Late in the afternoon, as the wind picks up and the snow begins to blow around, I find myself way up on a giant hill on the mainland across the lagoon from Kivalina. Millie Holly and I drove about 7 miles to get here.
What do you think from up here?
Windy.
It's windy.
We came out here on a brand new evacuation road. After years of fighting, the village is finally getting one. It's still under construction, but it could help solve another problem when it's complete. The road leads to the site of a new school, right where we're standing. Millie says it could be open by 2021.
Yeah, it's a whole new place to think about home.
One day, Millie wants to see the entire village move up here, where it's safe from the sea. But not everyone likes this location, and there's still no funding to make that happen. In a lot of ways, relocating Kivalina is still just a dream. But Millie's feeling hopeful for the first time in a long while.
It's awesome. Yay!
You seem so excited.
I am. I'm happy. Oh my goodness.
Thanks to reporter Emily Schwing for that story. Our lead producer for this week's show is Catherine Miskowski. Brett Myers edited today's show. Thanks to Peter Thompson and Andrea Crossan at the public radio show The World for working with us on the story from Antarctica, and to the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration and everybody aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer Research Vessel. Thanks also to KUNC Public Radio in Greeley, Colorado, for partnering on the story about those military radars in the Arctic. Our production managers are Najib Amini and Mawinda Inahosa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. That helped this week from Caitlin Benz. Our CEO is Kristen Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. And our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson. And remember, there is always more to the story.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.